Really excited about tonight and what God might say to us. It's great, isn't it? I get a privilege of reading this stuff before you do and just enjoying it. And then God speaks to me and I'm grateful, there's a word for the theme for this evening. I'm grateful for what I've already got out of my preparation tonight. Let's go back one. We are doing together a series in the first Sunday of each month, a very simple series in some ways, but it will take us to deep places. We're going to spend time being with Jesus so that we might become like Jesus and that we might do the things that Jesus did. It's really simple. A child could understand that idea, which is fantastic, isn't it? Because we want to do it as children, as little ones. Am I okay sound-wise? Some of you are frowning at me just because you like to frown then. Are you okay? Yeah. And are you warm enough or too warm?
Too warm.
Too warm. Okay, great. That's great. Does it help if I go back a bit or something? Is that better? Yes. How far back would you like me? Fantastic. There we are. So we're doing this series on being with Jesus, becoming like Jesus, and doing things. So here we are, becoming like Jesus. Some of you have been journeying with me on Tuesday nights, and you know that the word for Jesus' followers was disciple. It's the most regular used word, 246, I think, times used in the New Testament. And my preference for that is apprentice. And you know that it comes from the Greek word mathetes. You say that? Yeah, so here it is in kind of the way that I might say it. So I didn't know what it was when I read it like that, mathetes or something like that, but it says mathetes. And a mathetes is just someone who was with Jesus in order to become like Jesus and do the things that Jesus did, because a mathetes was an apprentice. So rabbis had mathetes. That's what you were if you became a disciple of a rabbi. You became a mathetes. And you just spent time, you hung out with the rabbi in order that you might pick up the rabbi's learning, but not just that you might pick up his learning or his thinking, although that would be good, a good starting point, but that you might then take on his heart as well and then do the things that he does very naturally, that you might become like your rabbi. So there it is. Now, I looked up apprentice on Google. I love Google for many reasons, but images. This is the most sassy group of apprentices I've ever seen. And this is the government. The government were doing a big advertising thing about trying to get a kind of people to sign up to apprenticeships. Wouldn't you want to be an apprentice when you kind of like look at them? These young people just looking so sassy. I think only the guy with the headphones over here looks like he's in the wrong place. Don't you think? Everyone else is looking. And this is the government wanting to get people to become apprentices. Why would they do that? Why would they spend money and do photo shoots if it wasn't to get young people to become close to other people, so that they might do the things that other people do and become like other people? You with me? And that's government policy, spending your money, our money. Because this is how we do stuff in normal world, in the world. This is how we live. So this isn't Jesus making up a new way of being human. This is Jesus working with how we do humanity. And it's a normal way of life. And so we're just turning what is normal into a Jesus-focused version of it, isn't it? We're saying we want to be apprentices to him. So we are going to do what normal people would do if they were apprentices. Now, the question then asks ourselves, are we apprentices? Do we hang out with him? And did we have the idea that we wanted to be like him? And ultimately, is our goal that we would do the things that Jesus did? Alternatively, we could go to church. Which sounds more interesting to you? Do you understand the comparison? For decades, we have seen people go to church and not consider the simplest truth that Jesus made disciples. And therefore, they have missed out on the reality of his life and haven't done the things that he did. And therefore, other people have thought, I don't want to go to church. I don't want to go to church. They've never been told, be a disciple, and they've rejected it because they never saw it. But Jesus makes disciples, and then the disciples go and make other disciples. It's a very natural thing. It's a normal thing. It's a human thing. Would you agree? It's a human thing to make apprentices of yourselves. I mean, that's what parents do all the time, isn't it? Every single moment of a parent's life is consumed with the idea that my children are not doing as I want them to do. In other words, you have a vision of what you want them to do, and then you want them to become your little versions of you. Have you seen people who bring their children up for baptism? They look like little versions of their adults, don't they? They wear waistcoats and fully blown dresses. These are children who moments before were wearing toddler outfits, and they're suddenly in waistcoats, little miniature humans. Why do we do this? It's normal for us to be apprentices. And all we're doing is we're just saying, we want to be like Jesus. That's just the switch in our mind. So just that's all. All we're doing is just becoming focused or clear in our own mind that that's what we're about. As individuals and as a group together. Wouldn't it be great if you met with other disciples and thought, how's your discipleship going? And that wasn't a strange question. Bless you. You with me? Does that make sense? You know, when was the last time anyone asked you about your discipleship, your being like Jesus? A long time ago, wasn't it? And if they did ask you, they felt awkward and you felt awkward. Not when was the last time you read your Bible or when was the last time you prayed, but how is it going for you? Because I'm struggling with this. What are you struggling with? Well, I'm struggling with this. Oh, well, let's have a chat. When was the last time we went out to coffee with each other as disciples who were trying to be like Jesus? Now, if you were an apprentice at a workshop or something like that, you'd probably talk to the other apprentices about it, wouldn't you? How are you finding it? I don't know, I'm really struggling with cutting hair in a straight line. It's really going all over the place. You know, whatever the thing is. We're just hanging out together to be with Jesus, to become like him, and to end up doing the things. That sounds like a good plan, doesn't it? Well, we can hang out here for a while, can't we? So the thing that we want to do is look at this passage. But before we look at this passage, Mark 6 passage, we want to look at Luke 6. Jesus teaches his smallest parable here. I think it's the smallest parable. I'm looking around the room for Andy Peck to correct me on this, because it's just the shortest parable. This is the shortest parable. He told them this parable. Can the blind lead the blind? Will they not both fall into a pit? That's the parable. Blind person leading other blind people. That was the parable. It's a good story, isn't it? It was Jesus' story, so I'm telling you it's a good story. It's a good story. It's a visual image, isn't it? Blind people being led by blind people and tripping up. Then he says, the student, or actually what he said was the mathetes, and we translate it in our version of the Bible, student. The disciple is not above the teacher, but everyone who is fully trained will be like their teacher. Now, can you see, just there's a few things to pull out from this, that Jesus is talking as if this is the point, that we might be students of someone, and he's comparing himself to blind people leading other blind people. Who might he be thinking of? The blind guides. Anyone thoughts? Any thoughts? Who are the blind guides to Jesus? The Pharisees, yeah. You see, he said, the blind leading the blind, looking around at no one in the room, sort of thing. And he says, but the student is not above the teacher, but everyone who is fully trained. In other words, he's assuming that there's a process of training that the teacher is engaged in so that the student will grow in knowledge and wisdom and ability over time, will become like their teacher. So can you see, just for Jesus, this is a condensation of his idea. It's right in the middle of a whole load of other stuff, tree and fruit and all that other stuff. But it's in the middle of a little bit of teaching where he's basically saying, this is what it means to be a disciple. To be someone who's growing with him, to become like him. Have I moved the jigger off the screen or something? Can you put this thing back on the screen? Yeah. Once you put the cursor back on the screen. There you go, Matthew. There you go. The point of... thank you so much at the back. We love you. The point of discipleship is to become like your rabbi. And the word that is used for that is transformation. And so it's, of course, that you start in one place and your teacher is over here and you're over here. And you see the gap between you and them, which is an uncomfortable gap, but it's a good gap because you want to become like them. You know that you can't, you're not able to do the things they're doing. So you want to become transformed. You want to change. You want to change. Disciples want to change. They're not forced or obliged into change. They're not doing it out of duty or obligation or fear. But they decide that they want to be like the rabbi. And the word for transformation that's in Greek is metamorphosis. Now, we know what this word is, don't we? We butterflies and all the rest of it. So here's a profound change in form from one stage to the next in the life history of an organism, as from the caterpillar to the pupa and from the pupa to the adult butterfly. Now, do you want to change from caterpillar to pupa? That was my mime for the evening. Now, Jesus is the butterfly in the image, isn't he? He is the butterfly. And we feel like caterpillars crawling around, doing whatever caterpillars do. And we long. There's a change that has to happen for us. Wouldn't it be great if we ended up like butterflies? That's the vision that Jesus offers us. But the question that we have to ask ourselves is that really possible? Have you seen any other butterflies around in the church recently, just flapping their wings like Jesus, looking like Jesus? Or are we a load of caterpillars? I hadn't thought about this before I started speaking this sentence. This is a new idea. I'm speaking. Kate's looking at me going, I know Richard's done this before. This is he's having a thought on the hoof. I am. But just imagine a church filled with caterpillars, but the odd one or two butterflies. And now imagine a church full of butterflies. That's our goal, to be a church full of butterflies who've been changed from, as was so beautifully played, from one level of glory to another to become like him. That's the goal. Dallas Willard, my friend, says spiritual formation is the Christian tradition, in the Christian tradition, is a process of increasingly being possessed and permeated by the character traits of Jesus, possessed and permeated like a tea bag, or rather the water in the cup. It's possessed and permeated by the character traits of Jesus as we walk in the what he calls the easy yoke of discipleship with Jesus, our teacher. So our choice is to enter into the yoke that Jesus offers us, to tag along with him, to become like him. So point number one, spiritual formation isn't a Christian thing, it's a human thing. It's what we're all about. We're all becoming like someone. We're all being formed into someone. The question is, who is forming us right now? Every moment of every day, we're being bombarded with ideas and thoughts and images, aren't we, all the time? And it's forming our minds, giving us a worldview, a way of being. It tells us what is good and what is bad. Question is it Jesus giving us this information, or is it someone or something else? Unintentional spiritual formation. This I got from someone who's really fantastic, a guy called John Mark Comer, and I'll talk about him later in other weeks. But he talks about how we're formed unintentionally. We are formed by the world that we are part of. Fight valiantly against sin, the world, and the devil. Why do we say that at the beginning of a child's baptism, or just after they've been baptized? Why do we do that? Because the world is going to form them, and we want them to fight valiantly against the way that the world is going to form them. This is the kind of way that we're formed normally. Stories tell us who we are, and they place us in a particular location. They give us meaning. Stories are crucial. Relationships are the things that shape our lives, aren't they? Relationships. Our lives get changed by the relationship. Whoever we have as a family shapes you enormously. It's a huge impact on our lives. And habits, these are the things that we gain those over time, don't we? And they become our rituals of life. And as they actually shape. Nowadays, neuroscience has moved on to recognize that habits actually shape our lives, shape our loves. You know, the more we do something, the more we love it. Have you noticed that coffee and beer doesn't taste nice the first time you drink them? Have you noticed? Did anyone go, oh, that's a beautiful drink. I love the taste of beer. What a nectar. No, you go, blah. Same with coffee. It tastes horrible until you get into the habit of it because everyone else is doing it. And there's a story going around you that coffee is a really good thing and everybody's doing it. And so you get with it because your relationships really matter to you. Then you start drinking it. And then over time you begin to like it for some strange reason. Then you're hooked. Stories. Have anyone read this book, Sapiens? One or two. Yeah, one or two. One of you, if you haven't read it, don't worry. It's not a test. It's a brief history of humankind in a few hundred pages, 1,000 pages, I don't know. It's quite a big book. But if you want to watch him speak, the guy, Yuval Noah Harari, he's a Jewish guy, lives in Israel and speaks Hebrew, and a really interesting thinker. And I recommend you watch a YouTube of him or something like that, just to get into what he thinks. He says some really interesting things. Now, he's not a Christian, health warning, so he's not going to tell you everything about the way the world is. But he does tell us something very interesting, and he says that stories shape every bit of our lives. So this is a quote, and this was last week. He was on Start the Week last week. That's how he's at the top of his game right now. And he said this in his first opening paragraph. We conquered the planet, that's sapiens, conquered the planet, because we are the only mammals who can cooperate in very large numbers. Chimpanzees and gorillas cooperate in groups of about a dozen, but we cooperate in millions. And all of our achievements, from building the pyramids to flying to the moon, are the result of mass cooperation. Chimpanzees, they're groups of 10 or 12. Small groups, tribal groups, fight each other. Us, we cooperate in hundreds and thousands and millions even. And we achieve incredible things. This sets us apart. It makes sapiens the best mammals on the planet, taking over the planet. And mass cooperation is in turn founded on storytelling. Because if you examine any large-scale human cooperation, you will always find some fictional story at the basis. Now, he uses the word fictional story. And there is a story at the basis of everything. And the current story of our world is money. Money is a story. He's interested in stories, not just the Christian ones, although he will map out the religious stories, but he will also map out the liberal humanist stories as well. And he'll say that these are the stories that are dominating our worldview at the moment. And he talks about money as a story. Money is a story. It's a made-up story. It's not a real thing. Money is a story that we tell each other. And we've all bought into it, literally. and so there we live with the idea of money. Money didn't always exist. We were humans before there was money. You're with me on this. But we tell a story, and now money rules everything. That's interesting to me. He's onto something. Money holds us. We cooperate because of money in a way we would never cooperate without the story of money. Isn't that interesting? So he's saying stories are really important. Joan Didion said, we tell ourselves stories in order to live. Neil McGregor, and he's the guy who runs what's the museum in the center of town? The British Museum or something. He used to run the British Museum. And he's doing a fantastic thing about the history of religion at the moment. Really interesting thing on BBC iPlayer or something. At the beginning of the 20th century, the French sociologist Émile Durkheim argued that there can be, in fact, no society unless it has shared overarching stories. So Durkheim, 19-something, or maybe even 18-something, actually, probably, he called this what he called an idea that it constructs of itself, that shared communal idea or ideal, and its narratives were the precondition of a functioning society. We are, as a group, the stories that we tell about ourselves. We are, as a group, the stories that we tell about ourselves. Now, we sang a story. Did you hear the song that we sang? Death has been beaten. And we sang that story to ourselves. And did you notice what happened to us? We became one group, one with a very clear idea of ourselves. And we were moved in our emotions. I was moved in my emotions as I sang about the lamb that was slain. And I began to imagine the reality of that. And I was thinking, death has been overcome. And the truth of that story became real to me in almost a physical way as I was singing that. And I was very excited about that in that moment. And it almost made me say hallelujah in a different way to an English person. You know, I was on the edge of breaking out into non-Englishness because of the reality of that experience of thinking, there's a story. Now, that was our story. That is our story. Stories form us. If for whatever reason we lose or forget those narratives, we collectively no longer exist. That's really interesting. In the rituals and ceremonies, do you think we've got a united kingdom anymore? Or have we got a fragmented one? We've got a fragmented one. That's because there's no uniting story behind our purpose, is there? We no longer exist. In the rituals and ceremonies in which we are enacted, the society may be worshipping a remote, perhaps even non-existent god. It is also, Durkheim suggested, venerating an ideal version of itself, which may one day be made real. Now, he's just talking sociologically here, but it's really interesting. What about relationships? Anyone heard of John Bowlby? Yes, well, a lot of us have. You know, if you've got a parent, if you're a parent, you'll know about some of this idea, even if you don't know where it comes from. And this is the idea that relationships shape every bit of our lives. Attachment theory. You know, so if you separate a child from a mother or a significant other right at birth, it makes a huge difference to their mental break kind of development. It's hugely important that they're connected. Relationships shape everything. And a guy who's worked out, a more recent guy, Dan Siegel, he's written books and lots of books about this, how our relationships shape us. This is so true. And then what about habits? Well, this guy, Charles Duhigg, has written a book, The Power of Habit. I really recommend that book. It's really interesting. If you're struggling with an area of your life, I really recommend that you buy this book and then apply the principles as a Christian. Just nick the principles of this book to your life. And basically what he's doing is he's doing spiritual formation for non-spiritual people. He's habit formation is what Jesus offers us when he offers us his way of life. This is my yoke I give you. And I really recommend this. So stories, relationships, and habits. But in intentional spiritual formation, as opposed to unintentional, it has the Holy Spirit at the beginning, and it swaps these around, makes them slightly differently. Instead of stories, we have teaching. Instead of relationships, we have community. And instead of practices, instead of habits, we have practices. Does this, you understand what's going on here? Now, these are the three I's that I come up with: instruction, immersion, and imitation. This is how I found myself writing about these three I's, and then I read John Mark Comer, and I noticed that he was saying exactly the same thing, and I was all excited. Point number two, spiritual formation was the first point, is normal, it's a human thing. Point number two, Jesus had a life. Everyone say that.
Jesus had a life.
Yeah, think about that for a moment. Because of the contemporary bias with which you read the Gospels, we have great difficulty seeing the main emphasis in his life. We forget that being the unique Son of God clearly did not relieve him of the necessity of a life in preparation that was mainly spent out of the public eye. He had a life before he had a ministry. Are you with me? In spite of the auspicious events surrounding his birth, he grew up in the seclusion of a simple family in lowly Nazareth. At the age of 12, as Luke 2:45 tells us, he exhibited astonishing understanding in the midst of the doctors in Jerusalem. Yet he returned to his home with his parents and for the next 18 years was subject to the demands of his family. Then, after receiving baptism at the hands of his cousin, John the Baptist, Jesus was in solitude and fasted for a month and a half. Afterward, as his ministry proceeded, he was alone much of the time, often spending the entire night in solitude and prayer before serving the needs of his disciples and hearers of the following day. Out of such preparation, this is a quote from Dallas Willard, another beautiful quote. Out of such preparation, Jesus was able to lead a public life of service through teaching and healing. He had a life. He had an internal life. He had a life of his own with the Father. He had a life. And out of that life came his life. It's a good point, isn't it? So the question that asks me is, Rich, what's your life? What does it look like? What are you doing with your life so that out of your life, you then have a life that you present to other people? He was able to love his closest companions to the end, even though they often disappointed him greatly and seemed incapable of entering into his faith, and it seemed incapable of entering into his faith and works. And then he was able to die a death unsurpassed for its intrinsic beauty and historical effect. What led him to the cross was his inner life. It was that gave him the resources to step out and open his arms up on the cross. If we want to follow him, we have to follow him all the way through. We can't just get to the end point and go, let's just sacrifice our lives. No, we have to follow him on the internal journey as well. Does this make sense? In other words, we have to have his internal life. We have to have the practices of Jesus that might end up us being the external Jesus. So we'd be with him to become like him, to do the things that Jesus did. We often want to just do the things that he did. Turn the other cheek, be nice. Or whatever. That's not what Jesus said, actually. Be nice. It wasn't one of the things he said. And in this truth lies the secret of the easy yoke. The secret involves living as he lived in the entirety of his life, adopting his overall lifestyle. Following in his steps cannot be equated with behaving as he did when he was on the spot. To live as Christ lives is to live as he did all of his life. So gratitude. How many times have we heard the idea that we ought to be grateful? This is the kind of school assembly version of Jesus' teaching, isn't it? Jesus was thankful. Be thankful, children. Be thankful. And then 101 reasons why we should be thankful. Yeah. What we don't give ourselves is the thing that leads us to being grateful or understand what gratefulness is actually doing for us. I think both thankfulness works. I think thankfulness is a practice that helps us to become thankful. I think thankfulness, gratefulness, gratitude is something that helps us to become the kind of person that we would look like Jesus and do the things that Jesus did. So the apostles gathered around Jesus and reported him all that they had done and taught. Interesting that. A little bit of chocolate cake in the midst of it. Done and taught. And because so many people were coming to him, they did not even have a chance to eat. And he said to them, come, be with me by yourselves to a quiet place and get some rest. This is, what is Jesus doing? He's inviting them into a place of rest with him. Why? Because this is important for their external ministry. They need to retreat to have an internal world. How's your internal world going? So they went away by themselves in a boat to a solitary place. But many of them saw that saw him leaving and recognized the place. And ran on foot. They were desperate to get to this man who was so magnetic from all the towns, and they got there ahead of him, and how disappointed he felt when there they were. When Jesus landed and saw the large crowd, he had compassion on them. So he moves from being disappointed to having compassion in one easy step. Where did that come from? Did he switch on compassion? No, he didn't. He had spent time with God for all those years. He'd spent time in him. And he was stepping out of that. And what was the outcome? It was compassion. If you don't feel compassion with the people you're working with tomorrow, don't just think, I've got to put on compassion. Think, what have I got to do inside my internal world so that when I arrive at work tomorrow morning, I have compassion? You with me? Because they were like sheep without a shepherd. So he began teaching them many things. The apostles gathered around Jesus, reported all they had done. And notice this bit. To rest and solitary places. I'm just noting that. And in compassion, I've done all that. Okay. I'm mumbling. My mum would tell me off for mumbling. By this time, it was late in the day, so the disciples came to him. This is a remote place, and they said, it's already very late. Just like it is now, and you're wondering how long, much longer he's going to go on for. Send the people away. This is a word from the Lord. Send the people away. So this is the disciples' mindset. Can you see that the disciples are faced with a crisis? It's late. People are tired and they're hungry. Send them away. Send them away. The sheep without a shepherd, send them away. Because it came from their internal place. They didn't have resources in their internal place. They weren't fully formed yet. And so they said, send them away because we've got nothing for them. And he answered, well, you give them something to eat. What's Jesus doing there? He's presenting to them a gap between himself and them. They are send themselves away people, and Jesus is the I can feed them person. Isn't he? He's about to demonstrate it in a moment. But they are definitely send them away people. Now, Jesus, what was the internal world that led to this remarkable sentence? We think the miracle starts at the breaking of the bread. It doesn't. It starts before then. Jesus had an internal world. What was his internal world? I believe in God, the Father who made everything, who with his word can create everything and breathe life into everything. I am that word. I am not anxious if they haven't got bread. I am the bread of life. Peace as a result. And plenty. Jesus carried around inside him a sense of peace and plenty rather than anxiety and fear, which is what we often carry around, isn't it? It's what I carry around. Jesus presents a completely different mindset. And so he says, how many loaves do you have? And they say, well, go and see. And they found out and they said, 5. Oh, and 2 fish. I love that little bit. It's like kind of like, and we found some fish too. And then Jesus directed them to have all the people sit down on the grass. And they must have had no idea what they were doing. So they sat down in groups of hundreds and fifties, and then Jesus does these beautiful things. He takes, and Kate, it's so beautiful this morning when you just kind of modeled it with the way you talked about it. And taking the 5 loaves and 2 fish. So this is what Jesus does. He takes, he receives something. He receives the gift from somewhere else. It's not his. You notice that it wasn't his. He didn't have it, and he was completely at peace. He didn't have something. Have you ever not had something, and you're full of anxiety because you haven't got something? Jesus was the opposite of you. He didn't have something, and he was completely at peace. But then he was given something. It was a small thing, and he took it. He took it. He was grateful for it. He took it, and he was grateful for it. And then he broke it, and then he gave it. We're just about to do this very same thing. This was Jesus' kind of marker of the way he did his life. Here am I. Here am I. Here am I. This is the way he does his thing. This is the way he does everything. He takes something small. He then gives thanks to God for it. Do you know he does this on the night before he's about to be killed and he knows he's going to die tomorrow? And he takes the bread knowing what it means. Knowing what it means, he takes the bread. And he gives thanks. That is another miracle right there, isn't it? To know that this is your body and you still raise your hands in gratitude and thanks. The miracle was amazing, but what was it in Jesus that made the miracle possible? It was gratefulness. It was gratitude. Gratitude is the foundation of a worldview. It's the foundation of your worldview. If you can adopt gratitude, if you can take hold of gratitude, if you can live in gratitude, if you can begin to think 1, 2, 3, 4 things a day that you're grateful for, it will form your worldview. It will give you peace instead of anxiety. It will shape how you deal with stress and things that are complicated in life. It's the foundation of a worldview. It's an antidote to anxiety. We all put our hands up for this, don't we? Gratitude, if we start with the practice of gratitude, which is what Jesus did right from the word go, if you can take the whole of life and you can say, I am grateful for it, is an antidote to anxiety. Know any children or young people suffering with that? Teach them how to be grateful so that they can have an antidote to anxiety. There's this woman called Anne Voskamp, and Tori has read her book, and I just listened to her talk about it, which is why I know about it. And she says this, being joyful isn't what makes you grateful. Being grateful is what makes you joyful. It's good, isn't it? Here's another one. Thanksgiving creates abundance. Thanksgiving creates abundance. Here's another one. Every breath is a battle between grudgery and gratitude. Give thanks and you win joy. I'm not sure grudgery is a word. Is grudgery a word? It sounds like a made-up word to me. But I know what she means, isn't it? Every breath. Right now, grudgery. Gratitude. Let's choose gratitude. What will happen? Give thanks and you will win joy. And of course, it's the source of generosity, because when we're grateful for things, we just become so much easier to let go of it, isn't it? When we're thankful for the things, it just feels like it's a gift, isn't it? And when gifts are not yours, when you've earned something, it's hard to give it away. But when it was a gift in the first place, it's easy to give away other people's stuff, isn't it? Isn't it? And it's a discipline for the whole of life. Or rather, it's a discipline for a whole life. For a complete one. Brothers and sisters, if we could step into gratitude, we would discover so many benefits in our physical lives, in our mental lives, in our spiritual lives. So what should we do tonight as we go to bed? How about this? How about this as a simple practice that you can do? The fancy ones had a name for it. They called it the examine. Go through your day. Examine your day. And just think of 3 things where you feel gratitude. Think of 3 things. Ponder them. Chew on them. Enjoy them again. Enjoy them again. Celebrate them. Give thanks to God for them. Tomorrow may rain. Or it may be the best day. We can be grateful in both situations because God is so good.